Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580, the second hour of the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this part of the program, we'll be talking with a sociologist from Cornell University. His name is Michael Macy. He is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to be a speaker in an initiative that he is sponsored in part by the Center for Advanced Study, also the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, and the Department of Speech Communication, an initiative taking a look at networks, various kinds of networks that we see today, social, cultural, technological connections. That is the title for this initiative. And he's going to give a talk, and that will be this afternoon. That is right, this afternoon, on the topic, maybe it's not such a small world after all, spatial networks and complex contagions. That's this afternoon from 3 to 5 at the NCSA at 10:30. And I'm sure that anybody who's interested in attending this thing should feel welcome and feel that they could stop by. Here this morning in the program, I thought it'd be interesting to have him on and try to talk a little bit about some of his work that takes a look at social organization and how that happens. And the fact that, contrary to perhaps what we might think, it seems that a lot of social organization is not a top-down affair. It's not that someone comes along and tells groups of individuals how it is they're going to behave and relate and what they're going to do, but then in fact that it's something that comes often, that comes from the bottom up. That is, it's as he, I think, likes to describe it, it's kind of an improvisation that happens as people react with each other, among each other, and that it is something that percolates from the bottom up. Questions welcome as we talk. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you can certainly give us a call. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. It's my pleasure.
And we were just talking, the guest and I here were just talking before we went on about what it was we were going to talk about. And as is the case often in this program, we kind of make it up as we go along. So I was explaining to him, and I'll explain to people who are listening, that one of the things that really caught my eye and I thought was interesting was something that you had written now, and I think this was going back a number of years, that took a look at, as I saw it, and I would not claim to have understood all the theory of it, but the thing that caught my eye, the interesting question, was this matter of social organization and the fact that often in the past, scholars, people who look at this question of how it is that people do manage to organize themselves and sort of agree on what they're going to do and how they're going to live and how they're going to get along with one another, there was seemed to be this idea that it was a top-down phenomenon, that somehow perhaps there would be some authority structure, some figure, some group of individuals who were within the society or within the group who were saying, okay, this is what we're going to do and everybody get with the program. And what interested me was your work looking at the question from the other direction, that is saying, well, probably it's not a top-down thing. It's a bottom-up thing. And that interested me very much.
Well, yes, it interested me because trying to understand how complex social systems can function in a coherent and effective way with a very high level of complexity. How is that possible without somebody there directing traffic, as it were? And if you think of this analogy between improvisational theater compared to conventional theater with a script, an author who writes out the parts, and then you learn your part and you perform your part. It's very straightforward. Improvisational theater is messy. Who knows where the script will take us? And yet somehow the actors are able to hold it together in a coherent way. So we could extend that analogy to social life more broadly and ask, to what extent is social life like an improvisational theater, and how do they pull it off? How is it possible?
Mm-hmm. Can you give an example of the kind of thing that we're talking about?
Well, so some recent work that I have looked at has focused on the emergence of norms and beliefs in a very curious situation. In fact, sufficiently curious that people have written quite famous stories about it. The Hans Christian Andersen story of the Emperor's New Clothes is a classic example of a community that has become trapped in a belief that everyone privately knows is false. The story is of an emperor who is conned into purchasing what are supposed to be the most beautiful garments in the kingdom, and he is told that those who only those who are worthy of office can see these clothes, and those who cannot see them are idiots. So, not wanting to be regarded as unworthy of office, the emperor pretends to see the clothes, announces this to the public, and so everyone has to play along. And the interesting question about this is, how does a belief like this take root and spread in a population? What are the conditions in which that can occur? So the interesting thing about this example is, here's a case where the self-organization bottom-up process can lead into some rather curious and indeed perhaps undesirable outcomes. In academia, we have no shortage of naked emperors. we have prominent scholars who are widely heralded as the most brilliant thinkers, and yet privately none of us have any clue what they're talking about.
Yeah. Well, and of course, people recall the story that the emperor puts on his fabulous new clothes and goes out on parade and strolls down the street, and of course, he's naked, and everybody knows that they're in on this, that they're not supposed to make a comment on it until some child,
right,
who knows that who is not with the program, who is of course honest, points out the fact that the emperor is not wearing anything at all, and then the whole thing falls apart.
Which is where the story goes awry, because in the settings where we see these naked emperors operating, the child will have the equivalent of the child who laughs, the deviant. But this does not prick the balloon, as it were. The child would just be punished, and the norm would continue in place. And indeed, there's some evidence that having the child laugh actually can even reinforce the illusion. So that's where the story actually, I think, hits a bump in the road. And that was the starting point for our effort to try to understand this more thoroughly and more carefully, to try to understand how are these illusions possible? How do they get started? How do they spread? And why are they so difficult to dislodge?
Hmm. What is it? Can you give an example of a real-life naked emperor, one of these things where everybody in their heart of hearts believes one thing, and yet the norm of the group, the way that people publicly behave, the way that they talk, it would seem to indicate it was as if they believed something really different.
I mean, certainly, the example I gave before of the naked academic is a classic. But staying also with the college environment, college drinking, there are studies that show that although students will celebrate drinking and intoxication as the source of humor and jokes and of status and of prowess, in fact, privately, many of these students do indeed express a great deal of discomfort about excessive drinking and actually don't like this. That's their private belief. But when interacting with one another, they continue to express the sense of celebrating a culture of intoxication, as it were, of drinking as a source of status. Another example, cigarette smoking. Now, cigarettes are highly addictive. And so certainly once a person is addicted, it's easy to understand why they smoke. But how do they get started? And there you find cases where kids who grow up with the anti-smoking campaigns in the schools will have a strong hostility to smoking and opposition to it, and then they become teenagers, and smoking comes to be seen as cool, And what happens here is that privately, these kids don't like the taste and the smell of cigarettes, don't like the idea of smoking. But if you want to be cool, you have a smoke. And the language that grows up around it reinforces that sense of coolness. So what happens, paradoxically, is that kids end up pressuring one another to engage in behaviors that privately many, if not most of them, wish would go away.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, I guess in a sense, that's not really surprising in that we know that groups, the desire to be accepted is very popular, and that would prompt you to, in a sense, accept what you perceive to be the group norm as a way of being accepted by the group, even if you personally did not approve of that. It seems, we certainly see that, I mean, in those two examples that make that very clear. And but I guess what strikes me is that somehow the fact that the group norm persists, even though the individuals have a different personal belief. And it seems somehow odd that apparently it just never happens that enough individuals sort of sit down with one another on an individual basis and say something like, well, you know, this binge drinking thing is really stupid. I think it's stupid. You think it's stupid. I think other people who do it are stupid.
Right.
But how come, and that indeed may indeed happen on an individual basis, one-on-one or in small groups. And somehow, though, that never grows to the point where it seems to challenge or supplant what everybody thinks is the group norm. And it seems that somehow that has something to do with the fact that I think it's stupid, you think it's stupid, but we somehow think that everybody else still thinks that it's cool. So that somehow we'd think that we're out of step with the norm, where in fact you might indeed find out, as I think people researching college drinking have, is that idea that it's stupid is actually pretty widespread.
Right.
And the reason that people are continuing to do it is because they are misperceiving the attitudes of students as a whole. In fact, they're much more on the same page,
right,
except they don't know it.
Right. And in fact, I mean, these things do change. And one of the interesting things to look at is the way in which norms about smoking have changed. So certainly if you go back to the 50s, the 60s, well into the 70s, smoking was cool. Now, increasingly, smoking is regarded as socially unacceptable and undesirable, and you're something of a pariah if you smoke. How did that happen? How did that get switched around and flipped over? So these things do change, and they sometimes can change very rapidly. And if you look around at other cultures, I think the U.S. was somewhat in the lead in terms of the change from a smoking culture to an anti-smoking culture, at a time when then you would go to Europe and you would have a hard time breathing in the restaurants in the Netherlands or in Germany or France. The smoke was so thick. And yet now you go to the Netherlands and you find that they're actually beginning to do the same thing is happening there. The culture is switching from being pro-smoking to anti-smoking. Now, a lot of this is top-down. There are public health campaigns and advertisements, and many of these are very effective. But there's also an element that happens that's bottom-up, that happens through peer-to-peer interaction. Our research focuses very much on the network conditions that promote these changes and the ways in which the structures of interaction play a crucial role. And one of the main things that we have focused on is the difficulty for these norms to take root and spread in a network in which people are very closely connected with most of the other people in a large community. What really promotes the spread of these things is provincialism. That is to say, a network structure in which people have small circles of friends that they primarily interact with. And it's this local interaction that we found was key to the creation of a social fabric in which these unpopular norms, as it were, can take root and spread.
Hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Michael Macy. He is a professor of sociology at Cornell University and is here to give a talk about some of his research work. It's part of this initiative that's sponsored in part by the Center for Advanced Study, looking at various kinds of networks. And he'll be giving his talk this afternoon at the National Building of the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. Questions here are welcome too, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here in Urbana to talk with. Let's do that. And line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Really, really good subject. You were talking about the bottom-up feature of organization of systems. And I think that, in a way, I've been in advertising for years, and I always look at it as a voluntary thing. People voluntarily accept the message or they discard the message. And then I sort of extrapolate that into, like, propaganda from top down would be a government telling you pay your taxes or don't, et cetera, stop at the stop sign and things like that. So I think how people sort of look at that, maybe accept it or rebel against it. But and it's interesting that if you look at the, I was watching a program on genetics once, and they were talking to a guy who owned a company who created like yeast for people, custom genetically modified yeast for people, and they were putting all these sequences in, and he goes, well, what happens? And he says, well, it goes into this vial, and he said, well, how does it? He said, it just self-organizes. And he goes, I don't know why it does that. It just does it. And, following the sequence of genetic material. But I'm wondering if that has something to do in a much deeper sense with these principles you talk about, organizing principles. Would you know anything about that?
Well, the first thing I'd like to note is that this problem is especially important for people in the advertising business and in marketing. Going way back to the 30s, a very famous social psychologist, Muzaffar Sharif, wrote a paper about the psychology of advertising slogans. Why do some slogans catch on and others don't? And why is it so hard to predict which ones will and which ones won't? And actually, last week in Science, Matt Salganik has a paper actually co-authored with Duncan Watts, in which they ask, why do some songs catch on and become popular and others don't? And why is it so hard to predict which ones will make it? I mean, I'm sure you would love to be able to predict and know in advance what's going to make it, what songs are going to take off and which ones won't, what fashions will take off, what slogans will take off and which ones won't. And it's the self-organization of these processes that's important for understanding why it is so hard to predict this. And the Salganik study actually was an experiment that they did using a website for downloading music with and they had a very large number of participants. And what they found is a kind of self-reinforcing dynamic such that very early lead, just by even random chance, where one song starts to get a little bit more popular than the others, well, it'll kick into motion a self-reinforcing dynamic which will cause it to run away and become wildly popular, even though it's not more engaging to the people who are listening to the song. And indeed, what is likely to happen is it becomes cool to be familiar with and to like this music, so people then express it. But the way in which it actually becomes popular is actually random.
It's sort of like a herd mentality then?
It is indeed a herd dynamic.
Yeah.
And what generates it is that the early lead of popularity influences which songs people attend to, that they pay attention to, which in turn biases the probability that they will download it, and that then sets into motion a self-reinforcing dynamic. So no wonder it's hard to predict. It's because there really is no basis. You don't need to have a runaway advantage in terms of intrinsic appeal to become a runaway hit.
Oh, thank you. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks for the call. Next, we'll talk with someone also in Urbana. This is line two.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to the story about the naked academic, because it seemed to me like an academic could be a genius in the field in which he or she is a specialist in. They've mastered that discourse. They've mastered, you know, they're at the cutting edge of all the research. But I think that same person could be, I think you use the term foolish or not so well respected on their home campus or in their department, because when you have an office next door to someone, you see another side of that person. You know, there's multi dimensions to an academic. I'm an academic myself, so I have a vested interest in hearing an answer.
Right. I mean, there are of course many different combinations. There are the academics who are in fact real geniuses who are not appreciated. And then there are the cases of the academics who are really sort of just spouting a lot of nonsense and yet who are lauded as geniuses. And so it's curious to think about how either of those dynamics can get set into motion. And what we're interested in are those situations where people's public behavior involves pressuring people to believe something or to value something which people privately don't believe and don't value. And so it's curious to think, why would somebody who does not believe that the emperor has beautiful clothes or does not believe that this academic is saying something brilliant, in fact, maybe they don't have any clue what they're saying, they don't even understand it, why would they then publicly not only express admiration but pressure others to do so as well? That's the puzzle.
Okay, that clears it up. I also had something else I want to bring up about America as a society, how we have the relationship between popular culture and highbrow culture, it seems to me, is very thin in that we don't seem to have a very highbrow culture here, as opposed to maybe Europe, where there's, you know, coming out of the history of the monarchy and all. Here, it seems to me that what starts out as being popular culture, somewhat what you were talking about with the last caller, eventually becomes so mainstream that it's no longer popular. Is that what you mean by bottom-up?
Well, I think that's a good example, and it's a good question, the distinction between highbrow and lowbrow culture. Mm-hmm. But at some point, even for highbrow culture, these bottom-up dynamics kick in. And one of the examples that we talk about, actually, in our paper is an appreciation for fine art and wine. And we actually went into the lab and had a wine tasting in order to test the extent to which people would pressure one another to say something that they knew not to be true. So what we did is we gave them wine. We set it up as a wine tasting. We took one of the wines and we put a little vinegar in it. So now they've got two samples. One is the wine. The other is the exact same wine, but some vinegar. And what we wanted to find out is, could we get people to not only say that they preferred a wine, which they in fact did not like because of the vinegar, but would also put down people for not being able to appreciate this fine wine. And I think that you see that in the world of fashion and art in the form of snobbery.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe what we'll find is that the snobs actually privately are no different from the people that they're ridiculing. That is to say, they may not actually appreciate the wines that they are claiming are so superior. It's rather that they have heard that if you are, in fact, culturally in, if you're cool, if you're with it, you should appreciate this, and therefore I will express that appreciation, and I will put down people, ridicule, shun, whatever, those who don't have these fine and refined tastes like we have.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. It makes me think about the fact that one of the things that makes me think about the fact is just within social sciences, relatively recently, how popular evolutionary thinking has become as a way of trying to explain things like human behavior and how humans organize themselves socially and so forth. And I guess the sort of one of the basic ideas was if you take human beings back far enough, that one of the basic realities would be that if you get tossed out from the group, you're in big trouble. That it's very important.
Right.
It was very important for people to hang together and to stay together as a group. And being ostracized was you were dead. You get kicked out, which would mean that you would do whatever was necessary. You bond with a group, and whatever other people do, you do. You know, being a standout person is not going to benefit you in a situation like that. Now, I know that some people say, well, you got to be real careful about thinking in this way. You know, it leads you to make sort of generalizations, assumptions that may not be that this may not work, particularly not because this is not. The society now is much more complicated and much more different than what society would have been at that point. Having said all that, it still makes you think that there is in us still this very strong impulse to want to stick with everybody else, and that what we want to do is we want to be part of the group. And we want to do that so much that it will lead us to go against what we actually do think and say something completely different because we want to stick with everybody
right.
else.
Well, it's easy to explain why we go along with the group, and that's the social pressure, because we don't want to be shunned. Right. Here's the puzzle.
Yeah.
Where does the pressure come from? Why would people not only go along with the group, but contribute to the pressure on others to go along? I mean, that's the tricky part. So if you have a group in which everybody is feeling pressure to go along with something that almost all of them privately don't like, how can that be stable? How can that get started? And why is it not easily overturned by a single child who laughs at the emperor? Why is this so pernicious?
Mm-hmm.
And so the real question is not why people comply and go along with the group. It's why they pressure others to do so as well. And how does that take root and spread?
Mm.
The other thing too is that it's often the case that there's not simply a group. It's a network, and the network has clusters. And within that network, the clusters may have very different norms. So now the question is, which subgroup do you go along with and why? When we think of the term influence, we usually think of it as meaning that if I'm influencing you, it means that I'm getting you to do what I want or to be like me. But in fact, influence can also be negative. So my influence on you could be causing you to do the opposite of what I do or the opposite of what I want. So we can think about the relationships between people as being either positive, in which case the influence is positive, but it can also be antagonistic and negative, where the influence has the opposite effect. So if the teacher says do your homework, the effect on the rebellious student is to perhaps intensify their refusal to do their homework. And the last thing they would want to have happen is the teacher to praise them for their academic work. They're going to get a lot of ribbing from their friends. So the positive ties to their friends are pushing them one way. The negative tie to the teacher means that the teacher's influence backfires. And so knowing these relationships, whether the ties between people have a positive or a negative valence, is really key to understanding which norms will people go along with in a group. They have choices. It's not just that there's a single group with a single way of acting that we conform to. We still have the choices to make, but we don't make these choices just as we please, because we are embedded in a network with ties to people, some of whose opinions about us we positively value, and others we negatively. We want to tick them off by doing the opposite of what they're suggesting.
Yeah. Well, so I think certainly I can see situations in which getting a better understanding of how this works could be very useful, and that you could, through a process of observing people, conducting studies in lab settings, doing computer modeling, which I know you mm-hmm. have also done, to try to figure out how that works. You could, in the idea, I guess, would be to come up with some sort of a set of rules that would, or principles that would describe how people behave and perhaps predict how people would behave in certain situations. It seems to me that I wonder, do you ever, though, get your ultimate answer? Why? Why is it that, for example, going back to what you're talking about, I mean, why is it not only that people will, because the group has this norm, not only will they stick with group norm, even if they, in their heart of hearts, believe differently, but why it is that they will even pressure other people to stick with the group norm that does not conform to what it is they believe in their heart of hearts. I mean, do you ever think that there is ever going to be an answer to that question? Why do people do this?
Well, David, that's one of the wonderful things about being a social scientist is that there are so few ultimate answers. Social science is a realm that's really messy. And some of my friends who are coming from applied math and physics are really fascinated by the possibility of applying some of the technical tools that they have to the understanding of social life precisely because it is so messy and complex. And so we don't have ultimate answers for the most part. There are very few. And we have to be prepared to make incremental progress, to always know that what we're identifying are possible answers. Whether they are even probable, we don't really know.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Michael Macy. He's professor of sociology at Cornell University. He's here visiting the campus, taking part in this initiative sponsored in part by the Center for Advanced Study, The Age of Networks, Social, Cultural, and Technological Connections. His talk, Maybe It's Not Such a Small World. After all, special networks on complex contagions this afternoon at 3 o'clock and 10:30 at NCSA. So, and that's also, they're one of the sponsors, the National Center for Supercomputing Applications and also the Department of Speech Communications. We have some callers here who have been patient waiting, and so let's get back to them, and they're part of the conversation. Line 3, I believe, is next in Urbana. Hello.
Yes, hello. Good morning. Mm-hmm. I should start by saying I'm part of the very progressive wing of the Democratic Party, so you know where I'm coming from politically. When listening to you, I thought of two things that are very dear to my heart. One is the fight against racism, and the other is the desire to see the Democratic Party take back our national Congress and the presidency. And I'm thinking of something I happened to hear on PBS, of course, and that was a study whereby social scientists went and talked to people who voted Republican and who ordinarily were not making it financially. You know, they were just having trouble financially. And when questioned, these people's answer to why they weren't doing well financially was that they just weren't religious enough, or they just weren't working hard enough. And so I was wondering, you know, how does your research and how does your approach make an impact in the fight against racism and make impacts in the political arena?
Well, that's a great question. I grew up in the South in the 50s and 60s, which was certainly an important time in the area where I grew up of immense changes. And my personal sense from the area where I grew up, but also from more careful studies that have been done since, is that there were many people, white people in the South, who were very uncomfortable with Jim Crow and with the vicious and discriminatory practices that were that took place with in terms of both discrimination and prejudice and violence against African Americans. But it was also a situation in which people were afraid to express those views. And indeed, there would be sanctions against white people who expressed views that were critical of the dominant racist culture and practices, political practices. Now, the possibility exists that the people who were enforcing compliance with racist beliefs and practices were in many cases those very same people who were uncomfortable with them, thereby generating a dynamic which is in some ways a house of cards, right? Because it's what does it rest on? You've got people going along with something that they're all pressuring each other to go along with despite private doubts. When those dynamics get in place, the potential does indeed exist for very rapid change. And if you go back to when I go back to the area where I grew up in Tennessee, I'm really struck by how radical the changes have been in one generation. It's really quite remarkable. And I think this is true in many other areas as well. So this story that I'm telling is one of both bad news, but also good news. Timur Kuran, who is one of the scholars who pioneered this area of research, applies this analysis to the collapse of the Soviet Union. And just as before, I was talking about how hard it is to predict which songs will become popular. His point is that none of the analysts at CIA or in the armed forces or in the government were able to predict the collapse of the Soviet Union. And perhaps the reason for it is precisely that you had a house of cards that looked much stronger than it really was.
How can we use that in the fight against racism?
Well, that's another very good question. And the work that I do is much more on the sort of pure science end of the spectrum. I'm not really an applied social scientist. I don't work on policy or telling people how to fix things, more on the pure science side of trying to just understand them and explain them and have some better understanding of the dynamics. So this is a great question, and it's one that I do think about, but I hesitate to do more than to encourage you and other listeners to think carefully about it and see ways in which you may be able to find effective ways to intervene, or perhaps more effective ways to intervene by taking into account these possibilities thought about before. A good example being, what if it turns out that the people who are enforcing compliance with norms are actually the people who privately have the gravest doubts?
And how does one approach these people then to encourage them to speak out from their heart of hearts?
Well, in the work that we've done, we've focused on network structure and the patterns of interaction that are conducive to the spread of these unpopular norms. The implication of that analysis is that a key element here is that people have wrong information about the distribution of people's preferences. That was actually the point that David was making a few minutes ago, and I think that's exactly, he was right on target. So an important element in terms of policy and of trying to change these things is indeed to provide people better information about the true distribution of preferences. That's actually what colleges have been doing with trying to deal with excessive drinking, is to simply inform students as to what are, in fact, the true distributions of beliefs, what are the true preferences of students, so that instead of students sampling from their local group and overgeneralizing from that to try to draw wrong conclusions about what people actually think, let them know what people really do think. And so in some ways you can think of this as a sampling problem where people are overgeneralizing from what they learn about the behavior of their close friends. Friends who, by the way, may be feigning their true beliefs in order to gain acceptance by one another.
Okay. So once again, education and the spread of information and the spread of information about people's perception.
That's right. But, of course, these things are tricky because the thing that I'm talking about today, this afternoon, is that the spread of information is very, very different from the spread of influence. So The spread of information is like the spread of disease. You hear the information, you know it. You get the virus, you get sick. The spread of influence is very different. So if you're in the area of public health, it's one thing to understand how the virus is spreading from person to person and town to town. And it's very similar to talk about how maybe information might spread about what to do if you get the virus. But now here's the kicker. What about the spread of influence to change your behavior so that you're less vulnerable or susceptible to the disease? The thing I'm talking about today is how the spread of influence is fundamentally and qualitatively different from the spread of information and disease. And the difference is simply this. With disease and information, you just need to get the contact, the exposure, and you either get the information of the disease or you don't. With the spread of influence, you need social affirmation. To get people to act on information and to spread the information to others and to believe the information, it requires social affirmation. So a good example is what's called an urban legend, like, for example, that Einstein flunked algebra. Well, he actually did not flunk algebra, but lots and lots of people believe this urban legend. Why? Because they've heard it several times. The first time you hear this, you don't believe it. But when you hear it two or three times from two or three different and perhaps unrelated individuals, you figure it must be true. This many people can't be wrong. And that's a crucial difference between the spread of influence and information, that it requires social affirmation. You need exposure from several sources before you believe, act on, and further spread the information. And that has fundamentally important implications for the types of network structures that are conducive to the spread of, on the one hand, information and disease, and on the other, influence.
It sounds like there is a lot of manipulation that goes into influence.
Well, with disease and information, information is just sort of, you know, it's a fact. So you either have heard it, you've been exposed to it, or you haven't. A virus, you've been exposed to it, or you haven't. Maybe you get it, maybe you don't. Influence to change behavior is something that just hearing about it is not necessarily going to get you to accept or believe the information or to think that it's okay to do it. To adopt a controversial technology, to adopt birth control in a village where this hasn't been used, to believe some new idea. It takes social reinforcement. You have to hear about it from several different people before you're going to buy in and before you're going to spread it further. And the fact that you need to have these multiple sources fundamentally changes the network structures that are conducive to the spread of, on the one hand, information, on the other, influence. And the crucial difference is that influence requires clustered networks with a high degree of overlap between clusters, whereas the spread of information and disease benefits from just the opposite, from having random ties that connect people to very distant social locations. And that's why epidemics, of course, can be so scary in the modern world, because disease can spread really well in networks that have random ties between clustered groups. A few ties between continents or between disparate cities can allow a disease to spread really rapidly. That's not true for the spread of influence.
Fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We'll try to get one more caller here. This is a listener in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. I'm an academic, and I was just curious about something I've noticed over the years. I was at an East Coast Ivy League school in my PhD program, and something I noticed then and that I notice now because I'm on a series of committees, campus-wide committees as well as departmental committees, and in the humanities. And something I've noticed is that there are certain kinds of theoretical linguistic terminologies that are used typically in applications that graduate students and so on will use to try to get funding and so on in graduate school, and also for applications for graduate school. And also the same kind of language is used in even, let's say, 12, 13, 14 years ago in liberal arts academic discourse. What I'm talking about is, for example, the kind of discourse that at least I see in my own experiences originating in Michel Foucault, Jacques Derrida, and so on, post-structuralist, post-modernist discourse. And so certain kinds of phrases repeatedly appear when I'm on these committees, so when I'm reading applications of transnational resistance, of course, agency, local practices, flows, scapes, globalizing, of course, cultural borrowing, and so on. And what I'm trying to figure out is what moves, you know, in sociological terms, this ongoing use of the same kind of terminology over a period of some 10 years. I haven't seen much change in this, and I'm wondering what as a sociologist, you would, you know, if you do examine this kind of problem, how would you account in terms of network how this kind of use of discourse develops over time? Is it simply top-down? It seems top-down. It seems to be simply people incorporating or emulating Foucauldian and other discourses in the process. But at the same time, I wonder whether there's some kind of controlling mechanism where people have to use this kind of discourse in order to succeed within the networking environment we refer to as academe.
That's a great question and a great example, and it's a difficult one. And I don't know enough about the empirical evidence about these discourses,
right,
and their distributions to be able to say much about that specific example.
Right.
But I do, in fact, think that these dynamics are probably operating there.
Mm-hmm.
And the point that you make is a good one, that in the network structures that are conducive to the emergence and consolidation of a set of perhaps arbitrary rhetorics, that these dynamics can operate both at a very local level, just peer-to-peer, where people's sense that their close colleagues and close friends respect them and appreciate them puts pressure on them to use language of a certain kind. But also, it can also be the case that the central actors in a network, hubs, if you will, who adopt a discourse or a norm or a belief, they can spread it out much more efficiently to very large numbers of people. But the one thing to keep in mind is this: even though the hub is, if you will, the Foucault, the person who reaches huge numbers of people that are going to hear what this person says, they may actually have less influence than one might realize, for the reason that it may be that people still need to get affirmation of this at the local level. They still need to hear their friends say, yes, listen to what Foucault is saying. I believe this, and I respect people who believe this more so than those who don't.
Yeah.
So the bottom-up part, I think, is always operating as alongside the top-down. Or
yep.
The center out, if you will. If you think of this in terms of a hub with spokes, it's sort of not so much top-down as it is center out.
Yeah, one thing I noticed is that 10, 12, 13 years ago that people would talk about Foucault. At this point, people really don't even refer to Foucault, and I wonder whether they even know that Foucault and others, Potter and so on, began the use of these terms. A concern of mine, of course, is that when I do examine these things, you know, what are people doing with these terms? Do they know what they're talking about? Or if they do know what they're talking about, how similar or different is it from, let's say, the use by Foucault and Apadre and others of these terms? And so, yeah, I'm always trying to see what the content is that they're referring to and whether they're backing up these arguments in a constructive and convincing way.
Well, that's another really important point, is that these things change. And if we think of them as fads, and to some extent I think there are fads, not just in the humanities, but in the social and physical natural sciences as well, there are things that become fads that then change. And this is not to claim that they're not also really important, long-standing underlying truths. But there are fads about methods that are used. There are fads about the language that's used to describe them. And these things change, and they often seem like they're going to last forever because everybody supports it and agrees with it and celebrates it. And then you look around, and 10 years later, they're saying the opposite, and they vilify it. And it's not so different, perhaps, than what we talked about before with smoking, where the U.S. went from being a smoking culture to an anti-smoking culture in a remarkably short time. And so then the question that you're asking is, to what extent do these changes occur because the central actors, the hubs, change their views and broadcast it out? Or to what extent is that more a symptom, and the real changes are occurring at the local level in peer-to-peer interactions?
We're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time here in this morning's program. However, I want to mention one more time on our guest, Michael Macy, will be talking as part of a CIS initiative, The Age of Networks, Social, Cultural, and Technological Connections, is sponsored in part by the Center for Advanced Study on the U of I campus. His talk, Maybe It's Not Such a Small World After All, Spatial Networks and Complex Contagions, this afternoon at 3 in room 1030 of the National Center for Supercomputing Applications at their building. That's across the street from where we are. They're one of the sponsors, along with Speech Communication. Michael Macy is professor of sociology at Cornell University. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.